You're listening to the Happiness Patrol.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Happiness Patrol. We are on episode number 123, and it's a glorious rainy day here in Orlando. And the regular gang is back, and last week we did Troughton. It was fantastic. This time, it's Pertwee on the block. So Pertwee's head is on the block.
The head of.
Anyway, we'll get to that in a second. Right, Chaz? You know why, Chaz?
Because the Happiness Patrol starts now!
Yay!
So our only assignment this week was to do one thing, and do one thing clearly, and clearly we did. We watched Pertwee episodes, and we had doing it. But before we do that, hey, Chaz, good to see you.
Except you're not.
But I did get to see you when you were in Orlando this past week, and it was
yes, it was a lot of fun. It was huge fun. I ended up getting to stay up all night on a radio station and have all kinds of other adventures. But the highlight of the trip, without a doubt, was for anyone has been to Orlando, you have to go to Beefy King. That is the place to be.
Well, somebody didn't take me to Beefy King when I was there.
Well, you know, it ain't that great, Nancy. It's just more of a guy thing anyway, so, you know.
What is a Beefy? I beg your pardon?
What?
It is not. There are tater tots. They are an equal opportunity tater tot server.
Tater tot and kind of
okay,
people.
So if it's Beefy King, but the main specialty is tater tots, why don't they call it Tater Tot King?
No. Their main specialty is delicious beefy sandwiches. But what makes them stand out is that they also serve tater tots with it.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was great. And your play won, again, lots of awards.
Yes, I'm the stage manager for a show called God is a Scottish Drag Queen, hopefully coming soon to a town near you.
Yeah.
And it's
hilarious.
You should definitely bring it to South By next year.
Yeah, we should. Yes, we should.
It is very hilarious. I loved it a lot, but it was great. But now you're in Toronto.
Yes.
Doing your thing. So, you do so much stuff, I can't even keep up with you. So I'm not even going to try. Michelle!
Yeah.
Hey, baby. How you
Hello.
Doing?
I'm fine.
How's Texas today?
Hot as balls.
Which brings us right to our most pleasant lady of the day, Miss Nancy from San Francisco. How are you today?
I'm fine. I have two children who graduated this week.
That's good. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad.
One graduated from high school and one graduated from middle school.
Back in my day, we didn't have middle school graduation.
Really?
You became a freshman again, and you got beaten up by the seniors again.
Yep, that was just about the way it was. So,
We had a lovely but very filling dinner at Benihana last night.
Ooh.
Yeah, flipping the shrimp tails into the hat and making a little onion volcano, all that good stuff.
While in the greater San Francisco area, please visit Benihana since 1964.
Yes, it's having its 50th anniversary, too. Olivia noted that.
Well, I'm glad she had a good time.
Benihana and Doctor Who support the Happiness Patrol.
That's right.
As well as the movie game.
And they did have a vegetarian option, so that was good.
Now that our commercial plugs are over, Chaz... Yes. I'm going to tell you a secret. I don't know if you knew this or not. I know the girls have known this, but I don't know if I told you this or not. Back in 1983, the very first Doctor Who convention I went to in Tampa, Florida, I got to meet John Pertwee.
Oh, nice.
I had never seen any John Pertwee episodes. before because they weren't showing them at WFSU Channel 11 in Tallahassee, which was kind of, I felt kind of odd because I was thinking, oh my God, there's Sarah Jane, because Liz Sladen was there.
Yeah.
She's sitting there next to this crazy animated white-haired guy who was just, you know, amazing. And then, of course, next to the Hawaiian-shirted, curly-haired, Virginia Slim-smoking John Nathan Turner. So, but I was like, oh, my God, there she is. And she looked beautiful and everything. And then I was like, this hand reaches out to me. He goes, hello, I'm John Pertwee. I was like, hi, I'm Lewis Bailey. And I was just like, you know.
Yes. And you're still doing that today. I'm Lewis Bailey. I have no idea who you are.
I don't know who the hell you are, but it was great to see you. But he was so friendly and so accommodating. And it's just, you know, for my very first doctor, you know, ever meeting, you know, it was one of those things I'll just, you know, I'll take to my grave, my friend.
Yeah. Well, he's an amazing guy.
Yeah. And there's a reason certain people around here say John Furt. Fucking Pertwee. Yeah.
They do?
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
We did a fabulous late night panel at LI Who called John Pertwee. Fuck yeah.
That was a fun one.
It was late night, it was raucous, and really what we discovered is that John Pertwee is the Chuck Norris of Doctor Who.
Yes, he is.
He's the most interesting man in the world.
Underneath all that white hair is another fist.
By God. And a charming one. A fist that will charm you. And speaks charming, Nancy. You got to go catch a plane and fly the hell over across the pond. Doing any Doctor Who stuff?
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we'll visit some locations. I don't know. We're just staying in London.
You should go to that rubbish tip in Brighton. It's a park now.
Yeah. Yeah, really. So yeah, we're just gonna stay in London.
You have to go to Tooting Beck and see if there's a Yeti on the loo. in honor of Pertwee.
In honor of Pertwee. So speaking of Pertwee,
thinking, should look up invasion locations.
That'd be cool. For your own personal invasion, or are you referring to the Doctor Who story?
Well, the Girl Scouts are invading.
there you go. And you don't want that to happen. Hey, so anyway, what did you get to watch this week?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Me? I get to go first? Really?
Hell yeah, go!
Wow.
Go!
I watched...
Not so wasting, gal!
I watched The Demons.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's spelled The Demons.
Yeah, which they did, you know, apparently it was originally going to be called just The Demons, but then we interviewed him. Where's my brain?
Oh, Terrence Dix.
Terrence Dix. Terrence Dix decided that it would be more classic if they added the AE.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, so that was a conscious choice.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, I know. So yeah, and it's the only Doctor Who episode that has Morris dancing. I mean, come on. What's not to love?
and an authentic White Witch.
And an authentic White Witch, and it's season 8, and I adore season 8. I adore Roger Delgado. So
yes.
It's got much to love.
Yeah.
It's a little, you know, it's a little different for a Doctor Who episode because it really does kind of pull in the supernatural. And I think it was probably one of the earliest ones that had a supernatural theme, but then, whoops, it turns out it's really aliens.
Aliens!
But yeah. I like the way that they pulled in, you know, the whole thing that the devil, you know, with the guy with the horns and the furry legs, you know, that was something that was picked up in all these different cultures because these aliens had been amongst us for so long, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, very nice. It's a great story, and it's one of the rare stories where it being in black and white now actually makes it more atmospheric.
It's not black and white, it's color.
No, my version is in color.
Yeah, you're right.
I was watching the new DVD. That was actually part of the reason I decided to get this, because I bought the DVD, the reissued DVD when it came out, and I hadn't had a chance to watch it yet, so I thought, this is our perfect
excuse. I've mostly watched it in black and white over the years, so I was forgetting that they reissued it in color
now. Yes, it is in proper color now.
Yay!
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good one. I recommend it.
Yeah, that's cool. So any special guest stars on this we need to be aware of?
Oh.
Anybody who went on to do anything else?
Let me see. It has Mike Yates, of course. It has Yates. It has Katie. It has, Joe Grant. It's Joe Grant and the Master and the Brigadier. Oh, there's some great Brigadier bits in there. Oh, well, of course, this is one of everybody's favorite Brig lines. Chap with the wings, five rounds rapid.
This is, if I'm not mistaken, this is the story in which the father of Osgood appears.
Yes. Yeah, that's another thing. The name Osgood popped up, and I was like,
Yeah. Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
He pops up again, although I cannot for the life of me remember where. Sergeant but he's like Osgood. Sergeant Osgood is this sort of long-suffering engineer who's always like, the doctor asks him to do something impossible, and he's like, I can't. That's not possible. And then he's like, all right, well, look. And then he draws this complicated thing. And then he's like, go do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that heat barrier thing was amazing.
Yes.
I loved it.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a great episode, you know. And it gets a little flack because, you know, the cheesy rubber suit. But, you know, hey, come on. Everybody loves Talons of Wing Chiang, and it's got that funky giant rat, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
So and it's racist.
I think what they like about the Talons of Wen Chiang is Leela in her underpinnings. I think so. I don't think it's the rat the rat is just the impetus for the underpinnings.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I would definitely recommend the Demons, especially the reissued DVDs, because it is in color. And and it also has, the DVD has some lovely extras. It has a tribute to Barry Letts.
Oh, cool.
It has some nice behind-the-scenes stuff, and it's really excellent. I recommend the reissued DVD.
I don't know if it's included on the DVD or if it's still available separately, but there is a wonderful documentary, I think made in 93, if I'm not mistaken, called Return to Devil's End.
Yes.
Which reunited the cast. Great stuff. Mm-hmm. Great
stuff. That's really good stuff.
Yeah, that's on
there. Cool. Well, that's cool. So, seven-parter, right? Is that right?
No, it's a five.
Five-parter, okay. It's so weird having these, odd-numbered things like that. It's kind of interesting. But I guess they did that a lot in that time to save money, mainly.
Mm-hmm. The five-parter format works for that story. It needed it actually. There's no completely unnecessary runaround.
Yeah.
In it, as there is in my
jail
story.
Cell or anything.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Nobody's unconscious for an episode. It actually works as a five-parter, which is rare.
Let's see. So that was season 8.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And with the Master.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of bookends. I mean, season 8 starts with Terror of the Autons, which is one I had considered doing, because I adore that one as well. Uh-huh. And it's this is the last episode of that season.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bookended Roger Delgado ball of loveliness.
Ball of loveliness.
A couple of extra notes about that. Dolores Heyman, who played the witch in the story, is still... She's just recently started recording stories, not for Big Finish, but I think it's for Telus Publishing or something like that. She's still active and still playing that character, which is great. And the other thing is the village of Aldborn, I actually had a chance to visit it in 96.
Oh, how cool.
At that time, anyway, I realized that was almost 20 years ago. But I have a feeling that if you went there today, you'd see everything that you saw in the Demons. They it's just a sleepy little village, and they don't change much.
There was a little, there was some footage. I think it was more recent than that. They still have the cloven hoof sign in the pub.
Did they change it back? Originally, it was called something else, and then they changed the name for the building, but then they just never changed it back.
No, they kept the sign, but they reverted back to the name. They just keep the sign.
They have the sign and on all, the mantle.
It was no trouble at all. And just walk around anywhere in the village and say to anyone over 50, were you in the Damon's? And they'd say yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, not even, because they were kids.
Were you one of the Morris dancers?
How were you one of the Morris dancers?
Actually, that Morris troupe is still active. That's one of the most famous Morris troupes in Britain.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, nice. Mm-hmm. I might have actually seen them then.
Yeah. They don't allow handguns anymore, though.
What is the name of it? The Headington Quarrymen.
What other podcast is going to have that information for you?
Yeah, I know. Well, you got to have people who actually care about Morris dancing.
People who care about Morris dancing really care about Morris.
Apparently. So there you go. Well, thank you, Nancy. I appreciate that. So five-parter, season 8. Go see it. It's the last episode in season 8. And
watch all of season 8.
I haven't seen that one in a long time. I got to go back and see that. There's a lot of Pertwee I haven't rewatched in a while. Let's move right along. Michelle, what did you get to see?
I watched Carnival of Monsters.
Ah, yes! Love Carnival of Monsters.
Yes.
This is the one that you show people, and if they get through it with the cheesy effects in it, you know you've got them for life. That's it.
Well, yes. As I have always said, and I've said many times, and I will continue to say, is the best thing about Doctor Who is just how earnest they are in their desire to tell the story. And they say, well, look, you know, we have this story, and we don't necessarily have the technology or the money or the time to really make it polished, but we're going to do the best we can, so come with us on this journey, won't you? It's from season 10. It's a four-parter. It was directed by Barry Letts, and the writer was Robert Holmes, and the script editor was Terrence Dick. So we've got a good, solid group behind these. Yeah, Joe Grant is the companion, and amusingly, there are two other main female characters in this story, and both of those women were on the short list to be Joe Grant. Oh. So, or as far as I am given to understand. So, Lerna, the Lerman sideshow girl, and,
yes.
Oh gosh, what was the name? Claire, the sort of, you know, early British flapper-looking gal on the boat. Was also in line to be Joe Grant. But when they chose Katie Manning, they told both women that they would use them at some point in the future. And so
I can definitely see where Lerna could have been part of that.
The other girl, I was surprised. But Lerna, yeah, definitely had a Joe Grant vibe. So a couple of interesting notes about this story. This is the first time since the Doctor was allowed by the Time Lords to use his TARDIS again.
Uh-huh.
And so he was testing out, he's testing out a new dematerialization circuit. And also, this is, as far as I can recall, I could be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, but I believe this is the first time where he says that he doesn't pilot the TARDIS, he programs it. And it's really interesting that seems like a really significant thing to say about the TARDIS, but it's a total throwaway line.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Where Joe says the thing that companions have said since time immemorium, you know, do you really know how to fly that thing or control this thing? And the Doctor says, I don't fly it, Joe, I program it. Now let's get moving. And then there are chickens. another thing is that this also includes a piece of Doctor Who technology called the Miniscope, which was later used in a Fourth Doctor story called, I think it's in Nightmare on Eden?
Yes, I think so.
Although it's called something different on Nightmare on Eden, whereas with the Miniscope, it's supposed to have been outlawed, because what it does is it captures not only living creatures, but also a piece of the habitat and sort of digitizes it so they live out their lives in a loop inside the circuitry of the device.
Yeah.
And in this case, basically, they are not only imprisoning animals, but also sentient beings. So there are some Cybermen, which I'm sure no one really cares about. There are these creatures, cares about cruelty to Cybermen. Nobody cares about cruelty to Cybermen. It's like Nazis. It's just whatever. They have some Orgons. And then they have some Earthlings. And a plesiosaurus in with the Earthlings for some reason.
Isn't that Ogron?
Ogrons.
Ogrons.
Ogrons. Yeah, it's like ogre, but Ogrons, which are supposedly a servitor race to the Daleks, but you never see them again.
They were the '70s version of the Ood.
Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize. Okay. And then the other thing that's great about this story is that it includes Ian Martyr in a very smart and sexy naval uniform, but he's not playing. He's not playing Harry. He's playing an officer on this ship. Yeah,
1920s or something.
Yeah, 1930s ship. It's pretty funny. And so it starts off and you don't quite know what's going on because there's one storyline with these sort of gray humanoid aliens on a planet called Interminer. They are a tribunal who have to decide whether or not to allow other alien races onto their planet.
Huh.
And they don't like their president. They've kind of got a thanks Obama attitude towards their current planetary president.
And apparently he's a slightly different shade of gray.
Yeah, he's a bleeding heart liberal because he wants to bring in. They have two races on this planet. They have the more refined and civilized people, and then they have the functionaries, which are these sort of very.
The working class,
and they communicate in grunts, and they're portrayed as behaving in a way that makes you think that perhaps they're not too bright. But clearly, there is some unrest among them because at one point, one of them gets up and appears to be making some kind of impassioned speech, and then one of the overseers just up and shoots him, and he falls off the ledge that he's standing on. And so the president wants to bring in these. Other cultures with the intention of doing entertainment for the functionaries so that they will be less likely to act out or rise up.
Cable TV!
Yeah, so they invite a race called the Lermans, who are very humanoid-looking. And so we have these two carnies, Vorg and Sherna, and Vorg has a miniscope. Another amusing thing is that this story was originally going to be called Peep Show, which would probably have created some unrealistic expectations, I think.
Yes.
But so, better ratings!
Yes, so they changed it to Carnival of Monsters. And the idea is that you look into the miniscope and you watch these alien creatures going through their lives in a loop, and you can set different settings so that you can make them more aggressive so that they fight each other. And at one point, Ian Martyr and John Pertwee, like, have a Queensbury Rules fisticuffs session. And so it turns out that the doctor has landed inside the miniscope, and this causes some problems. And then he accidentally gets pulled out of the miniscope, and then he has to do what the doctor does and try to get back in there so he can help Joe and the other Earth people who are in danger because the miniscope is malfunctioning.
This was such a fun episode and such a fun story, simply because... You know, that first episode comes on, they land, and you don't know what the hell.
Don't understand. Yeah, you know, you're like, why are we watching this side story with these stuffy, stupid aliens who don't like outsiders, and they speak in the third person? You know, one doesn't want to be on this tribune, but one must do what one is charged with. You know, blah blah.
But it's cool because it's got like a little bit of a with the miniscope and everything. It has a bit of a what the hell was that Matrix? That Matrix sort of feel.
A little bit, yes.
A little bit of Sapphire and Steel, where you find yourself in an odd situation.
Uh-huh.
Time is being manipulated.
Yeah, and also it's just really visually interesting, you know, because Interminer is very gray, and even the aliens are very gray. And then you have Vorg and Sherna, which are in these fantastic pastel, you know, carny outfits
like neon color type.
Neon pastel. And, you know, Sherna's got glitter pasted onto her face, and she's got little colorful ping pong balls glued to her tights, and she's got these adorable little things stick out of her hair and wobble around as she talks. And Vorg is covered in mirrored discs. Like, who was thinking that would be a good idea on a set? The fact that it doesn't have J.J. Abrams levels of lens flares is crazy. Like, somebody's really good at the job.
It's true. It's all true.
It has a little bit of a pacing problem. It suffers from a little bit of some awkward staging because the Interminer set is very cramped. You know, you hear stories about how the soundstage they had was minuscule. that really, like, they probably didn't have a lot of room for the Interminer set where they were filming, and so there's probably too many people and too small of a set, and so it gets a little awkward occasionally, but it's a lot of fun. It's got some great ideas and visually amusing, and also Ian Martyr and
Somebody really needs to cosplay those two.
Claire. You know, I was thinking that myself.
That would be great. I'd love to see that.
Use for all my old CDs.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. So cool. So what season was Carnival of Monsters?
This would be season 10. It aired in 1973. I should have done Planet of the Spiders because I recently discovered that I was born shortly after the last episode of Planet of the Spiders aired, but I'd already stated that I was going to do Carnival of Monsters. So.
Cool.
Interesting little bit of trivia for you. There was an arena show in 2010 called Doctor Who Live. It was actually a sequel to this story.
Yes.
That's right.
It starred Vorg's son, Vorgan's son. How clever is that?
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
And the Minimizer, which is not the Miniscope. No, for copyright reasons. So, yeah, it was. And by the way, the ship, I remember, was called the SS Bernice.
Yes.
This is where Ian Martyr got the role of Harry Sullivan.
Yeah.
Basically, because they just thought, how British is that guy? We need him.
He's super British, and he looks good in a Navy uniform. I had seen some Harry Sullivan episodes before. I saw Carnival of Monsters, and then when he came on stage, I'm like, oh, shit, it's Harry Sullivan. And I'm like, oh, he's not Harry Sullivan. And then I'm like, no, he's Harry Sullivan. Like, I think the reason that Harry Sullivan is so kind of, like, old-fashioned in his kind of, the way that he talks is because they loved him so much as this guy.
It would be fun to think that John Andrews, that was the name of Ian Martyr's character, was some sort of a descendant of...
Ancestor,
Ancestor or Sullivan. Wouldn't that be fun? It is, as I said before, it's just a terrifically fun story, and it is very much the web planet of its era.
Of its day, it is. It's got a lot of that.
Trying too much.
It succeeds better than web planet.
Yes.
And
has oodles of charm, even as it's got some kind of crude finger puppet blue screen.
That adds the charm. I love it.
But I can remember watching this. Well, it wasn't when it aired at the time. I wasn't watching Doctor Who then. But a few years later, in the late 70s, I finally saw this story. And I thought to myself, the only thing I could remember about the story for the longest time was that the Drashigs looked like Pez dispensers to me. And so every time I saw a Pez dispenser, I thought, I could make a Drashig out of that.
What they looked like to me when I was a kid, and I don't know if anybody else remembers this, but when I was a kid, if you went to a doctor's office or a dentist's office, there are companies that sell packages of little toys or little candies or little whatevers to doctor's office and dentist's office so that when kids are good, they get a toy at the end. So both my doctor and my dentist bought, you can also get them from like the Oriental Trading Company or whatever, but there are these little rubbery finger puppets, and they're usually made of like a semi-transparent colored jelly, rubbery, plasticky, whatever. And they have little arms, but the heads and the mouths, it looks like somebody ripped the arms off of the finger puppets I used to get from my doctor and my dentist and then painted them green and gave a little white on the teeth and a little red on the tongue. And that's what the Drassigs look like to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's freaking brilliant. Like, I did that.
Yeah.
I want to have a fistful of Drassigs. That would be great.
There you go. Cool. Well, thanks, Michelle. That's pretty cool. Now you got me wanting to go see that again. Go ahead.
I'll do.
1973 is okay.
It's only four parts.
Carnival of Monsters is a four-parter.
And last time I checked, it was available on Netflix. So that's kind of.
It is. So I didn't get to watch any of the extras like I did for the War Games. So I imagine they're fun.
So, Chaz.
Yes.
What did you get to see, Pertwee-wise?
I'm continuing my theme of watching stories that are now complete, that were not previously complete for one reason or another.
Uh-huh.
And so I chose The Mind of Evil, Now, I'd seen The Mind of Evil, again, back in the late 70s. I saw it in color back then because American stations still had full-color copies of it. And I know this for a fact because we recorded it on Betamax tape. Remember that, kids? And watched it a couple more times. I was much chagrined to discover later on that they somehow managed to lose one of the episodes, so the whole thing had to be black and white for a while because one of the episodes they only had a black and white copy, and they just decided to make the whole thing black and white. Now it's back in full color on a new DVD with episode one hand-colored by a guy named Stuart Humphreys, who is amazing. And then they recovered the whole rest of it from Chromadot technology, which is just incredibly clever. They're taking the black and white tape, over-scanning it so that you can see the color information in the dots above the picture. Those of you who had old tube TVs may have occasionally seen what these chroma dots. And they figured out, oh, this should be this color, and this should be this color, and they let the computer color it, which is fantastic, and looks exactly like it always did. Episode 1 has a slightly richer color look, but that's because, literally, Stuart Humphreys goes in and colors in Photoshop each frame.
Oh, wow.
Each frame.
God, I gotta see that.
It is stunning, and it actually looks better than the color on the rest of on the actual original episodes because he's using a slightly richer palette. But anyway, so I got to see it in color again for the first time in years. Almost, well, geez, 35 years or so since I've seen it in color.
Good Lord!
I know, and me only 36.
I know.
How's that possible?
So tell us a little bit about this. Give us a little basic synopsis of this for people who are not familiar with Mind of Evil.
I'll start off by saying it's a six-parter. Really shouldn't have been. Uh-huh. It definitely would have worked better as a four- or five-parter at the most. There is an entire episode devoted to doing something, and then at the end of the episode, it is exactly back where it was at the end of the previous episode, with nothing having changed. So you can tell, oh, dear, they've got some filler in there. But it's got the whole UNIT family, Nick Courtney, Richard Franklin, John Levine. Uh-huh. It's got Roger Delgado, of course, because this is a season 8 story, and he's in every story. It's got Michael Sheard in it in a very small part, one of his many appearances in the program. Yeah, those are most of the main notable names in there. The other guest star, really, and it's a full character in the show, is Havoc. The action stunt team.
Yeah, yeah.
We were very action-y and stunty in this. In fact, if you watch the story now, you're like, this is just an excuse to give the Havoc guys something to do. But yeah, because a fight breaks out every few minutes in this thing, really. So the basic plot is the master has come up with his Wile E. Coyote-esque convoluted plot. I will explain the master's plot and then the plot of the series. The master has brought a machine to Earth that actually contains a mind parasite inside it and feeds off of anger. Okay? He's hiding the fact that it's actually a mind parasite and calling it a machine under the name of Emil Keller, a scientist from Northern Europe somewhere that we're not going to check the credentials of. And he's taking it around on a tour of British prisons to show that he can rehabilitate prisoners very much like Clockwork Orange, which had come out a few years earlier.
Now I remember this one, yes.
Yes, yes. So it turns out that he specifically wants to test this machine at Stangmore Prison. And the reason for this is not to cure these prisoners, but to raise an army. Why would the master need an army of prisoners? Because a nuclear missile guarded by UNIT will be passing by at a predetermined date and time, which he apparently knows, being a Time Lord. And so he's going to use this army of prisoners that he's going to liberate to capture the missile, and the missile he will then put on his Dr. Evil outfit and ask for $1 million.
You know what? That's not as convoluted a plan as all that compared to his other ideas.
Yes.
We need to have a special episode dedicated to the master and his convoluted ideas.
At least it is a plan. Although you can, you know, at least it is a plan as opposed to like say, Legopolis with Ainsley Master, where he had no plan. He was just running around.
That's true.
So that's the Master's plan. Incidental to that, he knows that the Doctor is going to come and investigate this machine sooner or later, because that's what the Doctor does. And so as a bonus to the plan, he's going to use the, quote, Keller machine, unquote, slash mind parasite to destroy the Doctor. At the end of it, he calls up the Doctor on a phone, a landline. Hey, kids, this may be your first encounter with one of those. And brags to him that, well, yes, you defeated my plan, but I get to leave Earth. and buggers off. So it does advance the Doctor-Master dynamic a little bit, as well as being a great runaround in a prison with tons of fights. There's a whole other plot here in Mind of Evil of the Brigadier who is trying to juggle both the transportation of a nuclear missile through the streets of England... and a peace conference at the same time. And of course, the Master has his hand in that, too. He is also manipulating that to make sure that the missile goes where it's supposed to go, and all the other complicated fall draw. So the Master is playing multiple games here, and it is actually pretty nicely executed all around. It's one episode too long. There's an episode, I think it's episode 5, if I remember correctly, where... the prisoners riot. They put the Doctor and Joe in the jail. Joe manages to use her escapology skills for once to escape and bring the guards back, who then put the prison back under control. And then at the end of the episode, the riot breaks out again because the Keller machine is making them riot. And so it's right back. It's exactly back where we were at the beginning of the last episode. Nothing really happens.
Can I say, before we move on, can I say one thing about Mind of Evil?
Absolutely.
I think that J.K. Rowling had that in the back of her mind when she created the Dementors.
Absolutely.
Oh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I I've said this on different podcasts before, but as much as I love the Harry Potter series of books, anyone who is well-read in literature will know that J.K. Rowling is the most original creator in the world.
No. Well, all works are derivative.
And she borrows very obviously from things that she grew up with. If you're about the same age as her, and I am, and you grew up in those same circumstances, you'll recognize a lot of things that she lifted from.
Well, you know, there isn't a problem with borrowing. It's how you execute the borrowing.
Yes, she executed it well.
Yeah.
She is a superb chef, but she made a soup out of a lot of different ingredients.
Yeah, well, oh yeah.
I will wrap it up by saying this. It's a lovely unit story that gives every character some nice moments. Roger Delgado is fantastic. What I like about it is he's not actually revealed to be the villain in this thing for quite some time, which is nice. You originally, there's a red herring, you originally think it's somebody else, Dr. Ketterling, and then it shifts to him. But
that's what makes season 8 so lovely.
The story is terrific. John Pertwee is clearly very comfortable in the role by this point. He's totally in charge of the production. And last but not least, although I wouldn't recommend this as one's first Doctor Who story, it is really among the best of season 8 and the Pertwee era, I think, because it's got all of the things that we identify with the Pertwee era in one story. The Master, Unit, Havoc, and a story that thinks it's going to go into a super, well, not quite supernatural, but kind of a science-y area, and then goes into a science fiction area.
Yeah. I agree completely. If you hadn't grabbed that one first, I was going to do it.
And, of course, this is the time to buy it, because the DVD is out. We've got this new recolored version of it. We've got tons of documentaries that were made to go along with the DVD. So this is a Best Buy and a Best Buy to get it now.
Did you just advertise Best Buy on my...
No, God. I meant a good value. That's what I meant.
A good value, mind you.
Wherever you normally get your DVDs, but...
DVDs, what the hell's
this
that?
This is a good one to get, particularly for all the rich background information that is included. Well, it is a fucking seven-parter. Jesus.
This was a seven-parter. Now, last week when I was doing my review of Patrick Troughton, Which one did I do last week? I can't even remember now. It seemed like a long one because it was a telesnap, for crying out loud. But it went so nicely. Power of the Daleks is what it was. Mm-hmm. And it was, I was like, I was on the phone with my nephew yesterday saying, you know, I was watching that. And he was like, did you like it? Did you like it? I was like, yeah, it was great because it just went, it was so flowing, even to be as long as it was, and a telesnap. Now, this one, Ambassadors of Death, was so cool because it is classic. So classic John Pertwee at his doctory best, I think. You know, this one has, you know, UNIT, evil monsters, and lots of fisticuffs by Havoc. And, you know, and it's lots of going back and forth, running around, all that sort of stuff, which is classic Pertwee era Doctor Who. It's so cool because, like, first of all, I'm not a huge Liz Shaw fan, but in this one, she absolutely kicked.
Blasphemer.
She's
yeah, on it. I'm loving the Liz.
Pistols at dawn. I will defend the honor of Liz Shaw to the death.
I'm a Chaz.
She is just absolutely kick ass in her white go-go boots and matching vinyl white hat.
I think she is
running across this little, it looks like a little riverway dam sort of thing.
A dam, yeah.
Yeah, and it was so cool because, like, holy crap, it was raining the day that they were filming, and which is kind of weird because you don't see that too much in modern Doctor Who.
Yeah. Well, it was very fine English rain. It's hard to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, it showed up big time on that 16mm or whatever the hell they use at the time. Yeah. So the story is basically the British or the European Space Agency, the British Space Agency, has got three astronauts, and they don't know what the hell's going on with them. They've disappeared. They haven't been answering. It's Mars Probe 7. And they're not responding to calls, and everybody's very worried. And there's this really cool dude, I think his name is Ralph Cornish, and he's like the leader. He's like the main guy at the space station trying to get a hold of these astronauts. And they get this crazy-ass weird message that the doctor hears on TV while he's like back in his office watching this on TV because they're all like, you know, wondering about it. And he's like, oh crap, I know what that is. And he rushes down there and immediately, in very Doctor Who fashion, very, very Hartnell fashion, just takes command of the situation.
I was just about to say.
And everybody is like going, who the hell is this guy? Brigadier! Who the hell is this guy?
This is 10th Planet all over again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's so cool because, like, you know, he's just, the Doctor is an ass to these people, you know. Yeah. And he's
this is 10th Planet all over again.
He's smart-assing left and right to these people. And it's just, he does figure out exactly what the hell's going on in a very slow sort of way. But, like, there's a lot of plots and subplots in this particular episode.
Yeah, it's very rich.
Yeah, but the whole, you know, Mars Probe 7 being lost is kind of cool because they get to show some spaceship models, you know, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you're a kid in 1970 and you're seeing that, you're like, yeah, cool, you know, anything with, like, you know, all that Gerry Anderson stuff was so popular because kids love, little boys love toys.
Well, as you say, this was right after the original moon landing, and everybody still was seized with this imagination. And isn't it a sad commentary on how the future actually turned out that we didn't get a Mars Probe 7?
Yeah, really. Now, Michelle, have you watched this one before?
Yeah, I don't remember much about it.
Okay, what about you, Nancy?
Oh, yeah, I saw it a few years ago. It's been a while, though.
Yeah.
I definitely remember the rainy, slippery scene.
Yeah,
I remember the fantastic outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, like, she's running along this river thing. And it is very memorable because you're thinking, she's going to fall at any minute. So,
unless you don't.
What I find funny
about your fascination with it is for you it's retro, for them it was high fashion.
Yeah.
Well, I think Lewis has a go-go boots.
I do. I have a little.
Yeah.
there. Just to let you know. But that's new to the listeners of the Happiness Patrol, I'm sure. So now, another thing about the story is the basic gist of it is they got three astronauts. They're trying to find them. What they find are not three astronauts, but they're ambassadors of death. And there's an undercover plot by the government to take care of these guys and make a trade with these Martians, right?
Yeah, you can hold them hostage. Yes.
But nobody knows this except for the higher ups.
Well, so, this is a constant theme in some of the 70s Pertwee stories, because the producers and production team were not fans of the present government at the time. And so they would very often portray at least part of the government as being a rogue wing, you know, that want to go back in time, that want to go back to simpler ways, or xenophobic, or other things that the production team thought the present government, the UK government at the time, was guilty of being, and they just sort of exaggerated that those characteristics. You could certainly do that about privacy and xenophobia today. Excellent theme.
Well, the basic story is it's a revenge plot by this guy, who was an astronaut on, like, Mars Probe 1 or something. And the Martians accidentally killed his friend. And he got back, and the Martians wanted to make it up to him by sending their ambassadors. Well, he captured the ambassadors in an elaborate plot and is holding them for ransom and making them do their evil bidding, because apparently these Martians need an exorbitant amount of radiation to stay alive.
Yeah.
And if they don't do what they want them to do, they will, like, you know, reduce the radiation, that kind of thing. So, of course, the big mothership is coming in to take care of the business. The doctor gets involved. He actually goes up in a capsule, which is trying to be thwarted at every way imaginable. He goes up and he finds these three missing astronauts. Yeah. And that scene is so cool because, like, they're in this little waiting area watching this globe that's just, like, you know, kind of glowing. And they think they're watching, like, football or something, right? And so they're having a gay old time watching this thing. And the doctor's, like, going, hey, I'm here to rescue you guys.
Yeah.
And it's just really great.
And they're standing there like, go!
We have the 70s equivalent of internet. We don't need you. We don't want to be rescued. Thank you anyway.
So the doctor makes a deal with the Martians to say, hey, I'll get your ambassadors back. I'll straighten this out. Just let these guys return, you know. And they're like, no, that we'll return them when you get this straightened out. So it's a really clever story. It was really well written, actually. Except, of course, being a seven-parter, there's a lot of action-packed type sort of scenes by Havoc, which is interesting because there's a lot of unit guys just going in and trying to take care of things. And the Brigadier's like, sending them in this way and sending them in that way. And they're always getting their asses kicked by these other people. And I'm like thinking, these guys are a unit. It shouldn't take any moment, you know, like a moment just to clean this whole mess up. But no, they get their asses kicked. And it's so funny to watch it because I'm just thinking, you know, come on, Brigadier, what the hell?
At one point, up to 17% of the entire British male population were working as stuntmen for Doctor Who.
But there's ridiculous. There's a whole lot of action, a whole lot of chases, a whole lot of gunfire.
Yeah.
You know, there's people getting killed left and right in this thing. I was going to keep a count on how many deaths there were in this particular episode, but I fucking lost count. It was crazy. So, yeah. But it was great. The other thing I want to mention before I ended up, unit getting their asses kicked. The radiation. The Martians. They're in these spacesuits, a la Silence in the Library type sort of thing. Yeah. Almost. They're walking around, and they're really spooky. They're very spooky because guns can't hurt them or anything like that. And all they have to do is touch you, and they send like a little spark through you, a radiation spark or something, and it kills you. So they're running around killing all kinds of people. This one guy wants to, like, basically use them to, like, you know, rob Fort Knox and do bank robbery stuff. Because, you know, this arm of the government who has hired these people, they're like, you know, very, you know, nefarious type sort of personalities that have other like goals in mind instead of like, you know, the main goal. So like they're using these guys to do it. And it's just really creepy. The on location shots.
Yeah.
Are really very memorable, the way they were filmed and everything, and the special effects, which were very simple, but they were very, very effective, you know, for this episode. And that's the whole thing about the John Pertwee era is like there was a lot of 70s special, quote unquote, special effects that were just sort of cheesy, but they're totally memorable and they're totally effective in the story. All you have to do is just suspend your belief a little bit and just watch it and go along for the ride. And it was so much fun. I loved Ambassadors of Death, and I can't believe this was the first time I had ever seen it. So to me, it was like a brand new Doctor Who episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I love Pertwee really carries this.
Oh, just
amazingly well.
He doesn't need anybody at all in this. It's all.
Yeah, and as I've often said, if he was still alive, even though he's not, he's still the most interesting man in the world. And the guy in the Dos Equis commercials is just a pretender.
That's right. To John Pertwee. Wants to be Pertwee.
John Pertwee walks in and becomes an astronaut just on the strength of the force of his personality. Yeah, he's like, I'm the most qualified. I'm going up there. You know,
and they do a physical on him. I forgot. They do a physical on him.
Yeah.
And the guy in charge is like, we got your results back from your physical doctor. And he's goes, well, yes, there's something to be said about that. He goes, yes, there is something to be said about that. We've got no time to go into that right now. Right now, I've got to get in that capsule and go up there and rescue your men. You know, and that's all that's even mentioned about the doctor maybe being an alien.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't terrific. Not Sir James Quinnan, not that guy, but the first astronaut, the guy with the revenge thing going on. What was his name? General Carrington.
Yes.
General Carrington. And he is like so single-mindedly set on like announcing to the world that these guys are evil and these Martians need to be dealt with immediately. I highly recommend going to see this. If you've never seen Pertwee before, start with this. There's a really cute scene in the beginning of episode one where he's got the TARDIS console in his office. Yeah. God knows how he got it in his office because there's only one door and it looks like a standard size door.
I know.
I always
figured he brought it in parts.
But in the scene, he actually launches Liz 15 seconds into the future.
Then he
goes after her. You know, and it's all done just by, you know, turning
camera cuts.
Camera cuts. That's it. And but it's so funny and it's so cute to see that.
My favorite part is him calmly explaining what has just happened to Liz, who is dumbfounded.
Yeah. Aww.
Well, this is the thing. Liz was she understood the principle of the time travel.
Right.
She just didn't understand why she was explaining it from her perspective. From her perspective, he's the one who disappeared. And so he's like, no, I'll tell you what exactly happened. And then he does both sides. And it makes perfect sense, which you're totally on board with anything Pertwee says after that. He's one of those people, if he told you to jump off a cliff, you'd be like, now or in a few minutes?
Yeah. 15 seconds into the future.
Go see it. It's fun. I loved it.
Yeah. I think Liz Shaw doesn't get enough love.
No, apparently she has to put on go-go boots to get any attention.
Yeah, right.
I know.
Yeah. At least, I don't know.
But while I appreciate that she was a very different companion from the two that followed her, I thought she brought a very refreshing perspective, and it was a great, not only was it a great experiment, they may have thought that it failed after, because they didn't renew her contract after a year, but the idea of a companion that could talk on equal terms with the doctor, I think set the groundwork for definitely Romana.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways, Donna Noble.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm glad she was there.
It was very Women's Lib at the time. Mm-hmm. Without being too terribly over the head with it. I mean,
well, it was women's lib from a man's perspective, particularly.
I guess you're right, but it was great because, like, Liz Shaw, you know, she's a scientist, right? Or she wouldn't be there in the first place. So she's able to do what you said, talk on the level of a doctor.
Yeah.
But she was also, she didn't forget, you know, her feminine side.
Go-go boots.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, and she was cool. She was very take charge. And, like, when she's captured and forced to help keep the astronauts alive.
Yeah.
She, you know, her old professor is there who taught her, you know, science or something in college or something. And she's like, you know, what happened? You know, you were like my mentor, you know. And he's like going, well, you know, I had to go where the money was because nobody respected me or this or that or whatever. So, you know, it says tons about her character because she gets him to have more confidence in himself, you know.
There's a lot of themes in The Ambassador of Death that are still relevant today. And that's, you just touched on one of them, which is the government not listening to the scientific community and so on.
Yes.
There's a lot of relevant. In fact, that story may be more relevant today as we actually get a little closer to the idea of going to Mars than it was in the 70s.
Yeah. So that's it for John Pertwee. Next time we meet, we are going to be talking about my favorite doctor of all time.
Recently voted the best doctor of the first 50 years. Yeah.
Mr. Tom Baker himself.
I'm going to do Shada.
You're going to do Shada?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. That's ambitious, but that's good.
Wow, that is ambitious. Yeah. And Nancy, which one did you say you wanted to do?
Something from Key to Time.
Something from Key to Time, but you haven't made up your mind yet.
I love Rebo's Operation. I could watch
that. That's a great one. That's true.
Actually, all of them are pretty good.
I watched that more than any other one, so maybe I'll go look and see if there's another one I might want to do.
Uh-huh. Chaz, what do you want to see?
I can't pick yet. I mean, my go-to story is Pyramids of Mars.
Yeah.
I just love it because I love Liz Sladen so much, and that I just love her in it. Yes. But if I'm forced to declare one today, I think I'm going to go with, The Mask of Mandragora.
Ooh.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good one.
I'm going to go with that one, and I'll tell you why. That is the story that I used to win my wife.
Oh, really? I have heard the story via Dave Mitchell.
Yeah.
Because apparently you guys were roommates at the time at the condo of mystery.
Well, practically.
Back in the 80s. You need to tell that story.
Well, I'm going to say the whole story for next time. But yeah, I'm just going to say that this is the story that converted Heather, who had no experience with Doctor Who, into a Doctor Who fan.
Aww.
And cemented our relationship.
Aww.
So,
a very special story to me.
That is nice. Well, I am not going to declare anything just yet because I haven't made up my mind. There are so many good stories in the Tom Baker era that it just it would be unfair to me without actually going through the list and going, oh, maybe this one, maybe that one, maybe that one. Then take those together and go, maybe this one, maybe that one. Then take that one and go, mm-hmm.
Next week on a special 3-hour Happiness Patrol.
List
six his own favorite doctor.
Oh, really? So, but anyway, let's get on out of here. We got things to do and places to go and pizzas to eat.
We do want to say, though, congratulations to Tom Baker, who was recently voted the best doctor of the first 50 years.
Yeah.
A well-deserved award, in my opinion, although the competition was very close.
Oh,
who declared this?
Oh, Doctor Who Magazine.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, they came out with their best of the first 50 years set of stuff. And we can talk more about the results later, but Tom Baker got best doctor. And I'll go with that, even though I'm a Troughton man and a Matt Smith fan. I'll go with that.
Didn't he just celebrate a birthday?
Yes, 80-something to say.
Wow.
I think, he's getting up there. I may be wrong about that, so edit that out if I'm wrong. but yes, he recently celebrated a birthday, and he's working with Big Finish, recreating the Doctor now.
Which is lovely.
Of course, he was the heart-stopping moment of the 50th anniversary special. The cinema that I was in, you could have heard a pin drop when he appeared.
Oh, yeah.
And just, he rocks. What else is there?
What is there? There's nothing more to say, really. It's time to say goodbye, but we will meet again, and we will be talking about Tom Baker. And I'll be here. Nancy, you'll be here?
Maybe. We'll see.
Michelle, you'll be around?
Yep.
Yay, Michelle! You can't there escape you Texas.
No.
All right. So, hey, gang, if you guys want to hear, like, some of the rest of our podcasts, if any of you want to hear them, we have them all on our Blogspot. What is it, Nancy?
The.happinesspatrol.blogspot.com.
Okay, that sounds good. And also, we're on iTunes. Go to iTunes. Check us out. Go see it. You know, we're there. Leave us a nice little comment. Download us. Subscribe to us. You never know what you're going to get when you subscribe to us. There you go.
But you know it's going to be happy.
But you know it's going to be happy. And you can email us and say, hey, Lewis, what the hell are you thinking? So yes.
We say that often.
You can, too. So give us a shout-out. Send us an email at the.happiness.patrol@gmail.com. And you can find us on Twitter. Nancy's always updating the Twitter. And I'm always updating. And Michelle's updating Facebook. So so we're there. Yay! I appreciate all that you guys do. So anyway, till next time, gang, I am Lewis B.
I'm Michelle H.
And I'm Chaz.
And I'm reversing the polarity.
Of what?
Oh, the neutron flow, of course.
Oh, well, there we go. See you guys next week. Bye!
Bye!
You've been listening to the Happiness Patrol.
Did you get contacted by anybody in the last week about anything?
So remember, if there's an issue, blame Lewis. The only person on this call who has said that Apple is perfect is you.
The only thing I say is it sounds like he's eating something.
I was.
Yes, really. One less interruption would probably be good at this stage. To conclude about the mind of evil.
To conclude about the mind of evil.
Conclude again.
Lewis is clearly ready to go. So
he's all dressed up and nowhere to go.
So, if you...
Oh, wait, one more thing.
You're dock blocking again.
Oh, we're definitely going to have that beefcake and cheesecake thing.
More pictures of Ian Martyr in that Navy suit.
There you go. Yeah. There we go. I'll leave that to you. You take care of the beefcake. I'll take care of the cheesecake. It hits a plenty on Facebook for sure.
I'm reversing the polarity. She thought he said clarinet when he said trumpet.
Who can get those words confused? Trumpet, clarinet, trumpet. Not anything at all. Like.
Still a bunch of forced hot air through a tube.
That's what she said.
It's like, maybe I should wear my pajama pants onto the plane. I don't know. What do you guys do? When you do a transatlantic flight, do you wear your pajama pants or do you wear your jeans?
I wear only if
I'm going as a hobo. I was on an Aer Lingus flight once, and my stewardess was actually named Connie, and I just died laughing.
Wow,
so
time travel without a TARDIS
it
sucks.
Is.
Yeah. 3 hours at the tax accountant's office, that's what it'll feel like.
Yeah, but it's Virgin.
Oh, her name was Connie.
I'll tell you,
it suddenly hit him, huh?
It hit him. Ah. Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll bring a bandana.
That's not ghetto.
Yeah, really. Don't stop the fucking plane. Oh, you your pajama pants and your bandana.
I can just see you getting up.
He's packing.
And you go to the front restroom near the pilot wearing a bandana. That's fine.